It's been really interesting for me personally, what's been opened up in my psyche as a result of the killing of George Floyd and everything that has happened as a result of that, everything that's arisen as a result of that. It's been in the conversations that I've been having. You know, in the beginning, there was a lot of energy, a lot of people really seeking and wondering what's going on. You know, there's just so much hate in the world. Just how can we bring more love into the world? How can we make this world a better place? It's been really quite striking. And in a few of these conversations, I've noticed there's another voice that's creeping in, which is not surprising. It's a voice of people saying, I'm starting to hear people say, they're starting to feel a little tired and also perhaps a little cynical. I'm beginning to wonder if this is really the great awakening, you know, or are we just going to go back to same old, same old? So I think it's a very interesting time to come into relationship with what it is that we are collectively being called to do right now, and to become clear for ourselves how to respond creatively to the times. So in looking through the Pali Canon and just kind of thinking about, well, what would the Buddha do? It was quite interesting for me to actually revisit the Pali Canon through that lens. So I definitely think the Buddha would say some very interesting things about what's going on now, and also give some very clear practice guidance around what we can do individually and collectively to bring more love into this world, to bring more understanding and empathy into this world. So, of course, a very good place to start is what is the cause of suffering? In principle, what is the cause of all this hatred that we're seeing in the world out there, all this chaos? So from a Buddhist standpoint, I think Shantideva's quote captures something quite important. So I'll read that again. All suffering in the world comes from seeking pleasure for oneself. All happiness in the world comes from seeking pleasure for others. So I think this is a really interesting quote. There's something in there about him. All suffering in the world coming from seeking pleasure for ourselves, from being self-centered, perhaps actually exclusively self-centered. And it's saying all pleasures, all happiness in the world comes from seeking pleasure for others, from an altruistic stance. So I think this is quite interesting to look at, to explore our relationship to, or our experience of self-centeredness, and also our experience of other regarding, sort of the altruistic aspect of our experience. So in terms of self-centeredness, that's our starting point. We're all self-centered. So it's not a dirty word. There's nothing wrong with it. We're all self-centered. When we're born in this world and we realize that we have a separate body, and then we realize that we have needs for food, clothing, and shelter, and then we will act in such a way to get those things when we're actually able to act. So very much we are brought into this world with this sense of, I am me, I am a separate individual being. And yes, we are in relationship to others within community, within our circle of care. But fundamentally, we do have to look out for ourselves. So of course, in terms of getting happiness, right? We all want to get happiness. And we all have our own personal ideas of what happiness looks like for us. So then we'll spend a lot of time strategizing how we can maximize our happiness. But then there's times when we don't get what we want, or perhaps there's even times when other people are obstructing us from getting what we want, in which case we can view those people in a very adversarial way, kind of a combative way. You're getting in my way from me getting what I want. So I think that's... Yeah, so it's pretty straightforward dharma. this self-centered approach. So what Buddhism says about this is this self-centered approach, Buddhism actually calls this a distorted view or a wrong view. So there's one sutta in the Pali Canon. It's called the Vipalasa Sutta, which is translated as distortions of the mind. And in the sutta, the Buddha describes these four ways in which our views can be distorted. So these are commonly sometimes referred to as the four topsy-turvy views. These are the four distorted views. What is impermanent is taken to be permanent. What is painful is taken to be pleasurable. What is not self is taken to be a self. And what is impure is taken to be pure. So this actually requires quite a bit of unpacking to be able to map this teaching to our present day cultural conditions. But before I do that, I wanted to read the line right before it. These four topsy-turvy views. And this is the Buddha talking to a group of monks. And the Buddha says, "These, O monks, are the four distortions of perception, distortions of thought, and distortions of view. What is impermanent is taken to be permanent. What is painful is taken to be pleasurable. What is not self is taken to be self. And what is impure is taken to be pure." So this line preceding, it actually lists distortions of perception, distortions of thought, and distortions of view. So from a Buddhist standpoint, from a sort of like a Buddhist psychology standpoint, the distortions begin at perception, and then they progress and ripen into thought, which then can progress and ripen into distorted views. So in terms of distorted perceptions, there's definitely a practice method of purifying our distorted perceptions, in that perceptions is where the distortion begins. So in terms of purifying our perceptions, well, actually, first we have to address the question of what exactly is being pointed at by perception? And then what is this practice method of working with our distorted perceptions, and how do we go about purifying those distortions? So in terms of what is perception? So from a Buddhist standpoint, the Pali word that's being translated, samya, and this is what the Pali Canon says about this, and this comes from the Mahavadala Sutta. And here I'll just read what the Buddha says about this. Perception. Thus it is said. To what extent, friend, is it said to be perception? It perceives. Thus, friend, it is said to be perception. And what does it perceive? It perceives blue. It perceives yellow. It perceives red. It perceives white. It perceives. Thus, it is said to be of perception. So perception, this word samya, is pointing specifically at this process of labeling, of, call it pattern recognition. So for example, if I see this and I say cup, that would be an example of perception. Red, yellow, blue. And that seems quite straightforward. But what does this mean to have a distorted perception? So here I'm not talking about color blindness, where if something is green, you think it's red. I'm not talking about that. It's actually a distortion of our perceptions that arises from our beliefs, our thoughts, our views, our preferences, and our feelings. So here's a good example of this. Take the idea of beauty. And it's very much an idea, the idea of beauty. So bring to mind in your imagination someone who you personally consider to be beautiful. So now you've got an image in your mind of someone. then it's very interesting to think about this. Why do I think this person is beautiful? Why do I think this? Where did these ideas come from? Who decided this, that this particular person is beautiful? So it's very interesting to think about these things. And of course, beauty would have no meaning if it wasn't not juxtaposed with by ugly. Beauty has no meaning without ugliness, and ugliness has no meaning without beauty. So here's another way that, another example of the way our perceptions can become distorted. Let's say, for example, you're having a conversation with someone. And let's say the person you're talking to says something that just feels like it kind of pokes you. It kind of makes you cringe and withdraw. And perhaps you feel attacked by this person. And I know when this happens to me, once I start to cringe and withdraw, now my reptilian brain response of flight, fright, or freeze, you know, it gets triggered. And there are physiological responses to it. I feel a tightening in my body. And then my mind also starts to spin. Right? It starts to create these thoughts about, oh, I'm being attacked. It might trigger some past experience I've had of being attacked, or it might trigger a response of feeling wounded from some past experience. Or I might start to strategize. Okay, what am I going to do to fight back? You know, if the response is fight. And of course, while all of this is going on, I'm no longer listening. Well, I think I'm still hearing words. I'm still hearing the other person speak, but I'm not really listening to what they're saying. So again, this is a case of my perception being distorted by the experience of feeling like I'm being attacked. So again, this is just, you know, some various examples of the way our perception can get distorted. Yeah, here's one that comes to mind for me, actually. One of my tendencies that was very strong in the past, and it's weaker now, but it's still there, is I have a tendency to see problems. And the way that manifests in relationship to other people is I have a tendency to be critical and judgmental of other people. So I notice when I'm lapsed into this pattern, and I notice what's happening. What I notice is I see that what I perceive to be people's faults, I see those faults get amplified and come right to the fore of my mind. And then their positive qualities, they get shifted to the back of my mind. It's like I'm not even paying attention to any good qualities, and all I can see is faults. And then my mind just begins to generate even more criticisms of this particular person. And I see that as a distortion of my perception. Now, moving on to this notion of purifying one's distortions, there are a number of suttas from the Pali Canon which describe a training in the purification of perception. And again, a lot of these suttas, you know, you read them and you can come away, it's like, how does that apply to me, and what's some translation? But I'd like to read an excerpt from one of these suttas. And this sutta is probably the most well-known in terms of this practice of working with our distorted perceptions and working towards purifying these perceptions. And this particular sutta, it's called the Giramananda Sutta. What happens in this sutta is, I'll just read it. There's a little exchange between the Buddha and Ananda. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Shravasti in Jetis Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. And on that occasion, Venerable Giramananda was diseased, in pain, severely ill. Then Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, Lord, Venerable Giramananda is diseased, in pain, severely ill. It would be good if the Blessed One would visit Venerable Giramananda out of sympathy for him. Ananda, if you go to the monk Giramananda and tell him 10 perceptions, it's possible that when he hears the 10 perceptions, his disease may be allayed. Which 10? The perception of impermanence, the perception of not self, the perception of unattractiveness, the perception of drawbacks, the perception of abandoning, the perception of dispassion, the perception of abandoning, the perception of cessation, the perception of distaste for every world, the perception of the undesirability of all fabrications, and the perception of mindfulness of in and out breathing. So there's a lot there. There's a tremendous amount there to unpack. I'll just give you a very straightforward example of a practice that is purifying our distorted perceptions. And this practice is actually the metta bhavana. We can think about the metta bhavana in this term of purifying distorted perceptions and analyzing or investigating our perception through a particular perspective. So we can analyze our experience through the perspective of impermanence and not self. So in terms of the metta bhavana, if we consider the fourth stage of the metta bhavana, which is the difficult person. So even now, if I ask you to bring a difficult person to mind, so just do that now. And notice that there's a story that arises when you bring this person to mind. There's, oh, I can't believe that person is, blah, blah, blah. It's the story of my frustration with this person. It's the story of how this person is preventing me from what I want and all that kind of, there's a story there. And this story, the Buddha would call this a distorted thought. It's a distortion of what's actually going on. So in the metta bhavana, we have the opportunity to actually interrupt that story. Oh, this person drives me crazy. And we interrupt it with a different story. And that story is, may you be happy, may you be well. So by switching these stories, I would say that that is shifting our perception or shifting the way we relate to our distorted perception with a more pure perception. So I think this would fall into the category of what's being pointed at by no self. So this teaching of no self is really pointing at the fluidity of our minds, the malleability of our minds. That when we get angry, that's not a permanent state. We don't have to whip that into a whole world of experience. We don't necessarily have to identify with it and say, I'm really pissed off, and to claim that as mine and to experience it as such. We can actually learn to loosen up and open up our perception. And we can do this by bringing in an opposing view well. So distortions, they can come from concepts, ideas, opinions, beliefs, cultural norms. All these things influence our the way we think. So the Buddha also speaks about distortions in terms of conscious distortions and also unconscious distortions as well. So there's a sutta, it's called the Bhumija Sutta. And in this sutta, the Buddha actually describes acts of body, speech, and mind that that can be performed from a state of either being fully aware or from a state of being not fully aware. So I'll just read this little bit from this sutta. It's the Buddha talking to Ananda. Ananda, either fully aware, one generates actions of body, speech, and mind, or not fully aware, one generates actions of body, speech, and mind. Yes, I was really quite fascinated to actually discover that it's right there in the Pali Canon, but it actually talks about our unconscious drives. And interestingly enough, the Buddha also says that actions that are carried out unconsciously, we are still responsible for the consequences of those actions. From a Buddhist standpoint, unconscious actions still create their karmic, right? They still are coming from me, I, and they still have consequences. And those consequences could easily cause suffering. So in terms of some of these unconscious influences that can distort our experience, I would say that actually notions of beauty, that there is an aspect of our notions of beauty which comes from our cultural norms, which we can take on unconsciously. One that I find really interesting around cultural conditions that shape our minds. So that's the question I ask. How have cultural conditions shaped my mind in ways I may not notice? And also ways that I notice. So if I look at our modern day experience, what comes to mind is consumerism. This certainly has an effect on all of us because the advertising industry, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And there's a tremendous amount of research that's gone into stoking our desires and making us feel as if whatever we've got is not enough. And if we bought this thing or bought into this way of thinking, then we would be happy. So with consumerism comes this sense of I'm entitled to my pleasure. I want my pleasure and I should have it instantly, instant gratification. I think another cultural condition that shapes us very strongly is the internet, social media. So essentially these social networks, it's for profit, right? They're not doing this for free. And the more clicks, the more they make. It's monetized by clicks. So as a result, the business model is they want to spread our attention as thinly as possible on as broad a number of topics as possible so that we're clicking. So I'm sure we've all experienced this, especially during the time of shelter at home, of like randomly searching around on YouTube and you just click, 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 click. We're just constantly searching. So this can have a very strong effect on how we perceive our experience. It really shapes our experience. Right, so now moving into specifically what's going on in our time, I asked myself this question, well, I rephrase this question to how have my racial conditions shaped my mind. So I think this is a really interesting turn of phrase, like my racial conditions. And I've started using this turn of phrase, my racialized experience. So I wanted to share a little story with people, just very briefly, just a little snippet of the story. So my parents were born in China, and I was born here. So I'm a second generation Chinese American. And I have never related to myself as a person of color. My parents did not speak Chinese to me, so I don't speak Chinese. I didn't have Chinese friends. I didn't go to Chinese school. So my experience is as a white person. Or really, I didn't even think about my experience racially. I had no sense of it. And quite recently, after George Floyd was killed, another person in the sangha approached me and asked me this question. This person said to me, "Say, Donna Dasa, I was wondering if I could ask you a question. How is it like for you to be a person of color in a predominantly white sangha?" And I was quite struck by this question because no one had ever asked me this question before. And I had never asked myself this question before. And so this is really striking. And it opened up this whole line of exploration in my mind in terms of looking back at my family history and also the history of China that has shaped my parents, the minds of my parents. And the mind, the shape of the minds of my parents have had a very strong impact upon me, as have the stereotype of the model minority. So after a few days, I reached out to this person. We had a conversation, and I shared my response to this question of what is it like for me to be a person of color in a largely white sangha? And I'm not going to share that now, but I will say this in terms of what I've noticed, what I've learned about this, is that I've never related to myself as a person of color, and actually I still do not relate to myself as a person of color. But one thing that has become clear to me, sort of a way of seeing that's become clear to me, is that my race has shaped my mind in a particular way. The fact that I am Chinese American, it shaped my mind in a particular way. The history of my parents, the history of China, have shaped my mind in a particular way. And I describe that as a racialized experience. So right now I'm in the process of being jarred from my slumber around my racial literacy. And one of the books I'm reading, I'm doing a lot of self-educating right now. One of the books I'm reading is White Privilege by Robin DiAngelo. For me, that book answers a particular question of, well, in terms of a racialized experience, like, what does it mean to be white? You know, what is that racialized experience to be white? Yeah, so it's a very interesting question. So in terms of perception and in terms of purifying perceptions, well, before we can purify our perceptions, we need to know our perceptions. And it's not just us alone. You know, as Shanti Davis said, all happiness in this world comes from helping others. So we're also in community. We're in relationship with each other. And we also want to be helpful to each other. So in order to be helpful to each other, we also have to know the other person's experience as well, including the distortions. And of course, we can only view their distortions through our own distortions. So it gets very muddy very, very quickly. But for me, the key is to imaginatively stand in the shoes of another person. And that requires us, that requires me to ask and to actively listen. So in the same way that this person asked me this question, Donna Dasa, what is it like to be a person of color in a mostly white sangha? You know, I would like to ask everyone I come across in the sangha who's willing to have this conversation with me, what is it like to be for you? What is it like for you to be white in a mostly white sangha? What is it like for you to be German in a mostly white sangha? What is it like for you to be Mexican in a mostly white sangha? And then I would simply like to listen and receive that response. So before I end, I wanted to add one more thing to this, is what I see in this time of racial awakening or racial exploration. I've just become very aware that before George Floyd got killed, I really knew very little about imaginatively, like, what's it really like being a black person in this country? I mean, I kind of knew, like, I've watched Roots, I've watched, you know, 12 Years a Slave and all that, and I kind of sort of know my history, but it's really an intellectual understanding. I didn't really actually feel it. I didn't experience it. So before the killing of George Floyd, I've noticed that really I had no emotional sort of experience, felt sense experience of what it really is like to stand in the shoes of a black person living in this country. So now I have a much better sense of that. So now I'm going to bring in the topic, actually, this is the last topic, is this also applies, I think, to gender dynamics as well. So I think gender dynamics is very similar in that gender dynamics, it's very hard to talk about. And if you're a man, which I am, it's easy to not see. If you're a woman, you see it all the time. That's the reality you experience. And boy, that sounds awfully similar to what's going on with Black Lives Matter. If you are a white person who has very poor racial literacy, racism is hard to see. Or perhaps I should say, it's easy to ignore. It's probably a better way to put it. It's easy to ignore. And if you're a black person living in this country, it's impossible to ignore, because that's the reality you live in every single day, every single moment. So in my modest opinion, I think the Buddha would encourage us to imaginatively stand in the shoes of those who are marginalized and oppressed, and actively listen to them, to witness them, to make others feel seen and heard. I think that's the most important thing. So I'd like to end this talk by a quote by Dr. Martin Luther King. And this quote is very much aligned with the quote from Shantideva. So this is what Dr. Martin Luther King said. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? What are you doing for others?